Hi, and welcome to this episode of The Cyber Show. Today, Ed is talking to Jeff Wickman, who is a cyber incident responder and ransomware negotiator from SemParis in Seattle, USA. When it all goes south, when chaos reigns, Jeff is the calm and cool breeze who puts everyone at ease. In fact, Jeff is so cool that he took the fan off his CPU and just sits beside it with a bunch of penguins that moved into his office to chill out. He's going to be telling us why ransomware isn't even what you think, how massive at-scale corporate cyberbullying is carried out by gentlemen thugs who are better organized and certainly have better customer services than big tech companies like Microsoft and Google, and about how he lost his hair and finally won back his sleep after years in the trenches fighting cybercrime. Over to you, Ed.
Hello.
Hi, all.
How's it going?
How are you?
Great.
Wonderful.
Great. How are you all doing?
Welcome to the show, Jeff. We would love to hear a little bit more about how you got into being a ransomware negotiator. I presume that wasn't on LinkedIn or in a postcard at your local shop.
No. Sometimes I think it was luck, and sometimes I think I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. I started off in digital forensics and incident response. And actually, even before that, I was running an ISP back in 90-something, and we got hacked and just drove me insane on what did they do, how did they do it, how did they get in. Went down a rabbit hole. Started following forensics, got into forensics, and then a couple years ago, I was with a company called Crypsis. One of the functions that we did besides incident response and digital forensics was trying to help clients out with the ransom demands. One of the other folks kind of said, hey, you know, this right up your alley, you should try this. I did. And honestly, the first time I did it, I think it was like $100,000 ransom. I was nervous, like days nervous. And then it just became easier and easier. As you know, the process, once you get the process flow down, it's pretty much standard throughout different ransomware negotiation, you know, tactics and topics that you can work with. Then it just became second nature. The only time, I'll call it, I had issues was when the ransom demand became a number that I would never see in my lifetime. That's when I started losing sleep and losing hair. And yeah.
I was just imagining that you were going to put up a screen share there with you with a huge head of bushy hair.
No.
That was 12 months ago, yeah?
No, I haven't had hair in the 80s. It grows back. I just got to keep shaving it. It just drives me nuts.
I think hopefully most of our listeners have never really been victims of ransomware attacks, but maybe you could just kind of talk through the stages of an attack in your experience, kind of what can they gain access to? When do people realize when they've actually been attacked, and how does that sort of unfold in those situations in your experience?
Yeah, so the stages of an attack, and specifically a ransomware type attack, unfortunately, most people don't realize it until everything's been ransomed and everything's been locked out. I've seen a couple of companies actually, you know, catch wind of it and stop the ransom process. Usually still it's too late. They've hit the critical systems. They've already exfilled data. I mean, the attackers, they've got the leg up once they're inside an environment. How do I typically see it's phishing? I mean, tried and true. It is very difficult to defend against, at least in my opinion. There's always going to be a gullible person. I did I was working years ago when I worked with a company called Optive Security. We had a client, lovely old lady, who was the administrative assistant for the CFO. She would approve everything. And it was, I mean, it was the first time we said, we went in, we did the investigation, she got phished. And thankfully, it was only, you know, stealing of money at that point. They weren't doing it ransom. And, you know, we had an interview face-to-face with her, and we were just like, you cannot approve a transfer unless you are physically looking at the CFO and he says to transfer money. Yes, yeah. Yes. Month later, we were called back in. She wired up another 150,000. It was just like, and I think, I want to say in total, in 1 year, we did 5 business email compromises for them where she wired out money. It was just like, you keep falling for it. People keep falling for it. So that's how people are getting, or at least in my opinion, how the attackers getting in. Obviously, there are cases once in a while where you've got some rare exploit or some type of exploit that's going on in the wild that gives an attacker access into an environment. Once they have a foothold, any type of foothold inside the organization, that's when they're pivoting and trying to obviously either do recon, but recon, in my opinion, recon doesn't come until after they get more access, because if you're not an admin, you're blind to everything that's out there. So gaining access, getting a domain admin or a tier zero type privilege across the environment, then search. At that point, your search or the attackers are searching for any type of valuable data. Financial data is, at least in my experience, in most of my cases that I did previously, that was where we were seeing the attackers go. They wanted to understand what the company made from a monetary perspective. Typically, that's also where they kept their insurance policy. It's funny how they could come in exactly where they know the insurance companies are going to pay. And it was funny during the evolution of ransomware, or my experience in ransomware negotiations and payments, it went from blindly just saying, we want $1 million. And then it went to, well, your financial statement shows that you have revenues of, we'll say, $93 million. And it's like, and then I could, I don't want to say game it, but, you know, negotiate with them like, well, yeah, you're looking at revenue. You're not looking at everything. You're not looking at our expenses, our costs, and try to bring it down. Now I swear they have professional financial people looking at it, and they understand what the bottom dollar is and what they really have. And I think that's one of the other reasons that they go after the insurance documents. If I understand what your coverage is, I'm going to come in right at your coverage and see if that's what I can get.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of used to look at when ransomware attacks first became a thing that was known. It used to kind of be the, you know, petty crime kind of crypto kids that wanted a bit of cash, but now we're seeing more and more extremely structured and very organized crime related to ransomware and
very organized attacks. I think it was Evil Corp that was just in the news. They got taken down. I'm super happy to hear that. I dealt with them so many times, and that's where I think the organized part came in, because then it was, they were, I considered, it was a business. It was a professional operation where if the decryptor didn't work, they would, and I mean, I laughed at it at the time, they would ask for access back into the environment so that they could figure out why their decryptor wasn't working. I mean, it never gave them access. But it became funny of like, okay, I'm dealing with a help desk person trying to negotiate. They are checking with their boss. The decryptor doesn't work. They check with a different group. In my mind at that point, and I can't remember who I was talking to at the time, but it became evident and clear in my mind, like, this is your standard enterprise operation where you have a help desk, you have a financial group, you have a CEO. It just evolves from there. I don't think there's any light at the end of the tunnel either. Hate to spoil the show right away. Think about it. They took down BlockBit recently. And how many more popped up? I think it's just going to keep evolving, and it's going to keep happening.
So from that angle, then I guess we're calling victims. I'm sure whether it's an individual or a company, you know, massive organization, they're still a victim of the attack. When they end up in conversation with these ransomware gangs, we want to call them gangs or organized crime members, whatever, what kind of steps are there then that they can take to actually help themselves? What would you recommend in that situation? Is it all doom and gloom?
It's kind of doom and gloom. But in reality, don't reach out to the attacker.
Yeah.
I would say in most of my cases that I did where it was a problem or an issue of the negotiation process was because either the CEO or someone high up in the company contacted the attacker and said, F off, we're not dealing with you. And then they come to us and they're like, hey, can you take over this? You can do this negotiation for us. And it's like, we're already 10 steps behind now. You've upset the attacker. doesn't help. And then other cases that where problems happened was in the middle of the negotiation process, the IT guy is trying to get systems back online. So he decides to contact the attacker. And I'm trying to play the dumb IT guy for a small company. And it just shoots me in the foot from a negotiation process. From a steps perspective, so if you're an organization, reach out to professional ransomware negotiators or firms or incident response teams. If they guarantee that they're going to get everything back for you at a certain amount, that's a red flag, because there are no guarantees in ransom. And then from a process perspective of dealing with the negotiations, there are a couple steps that are going to happen. I've done a lot of cases where we get on a call with the client and they're like, we want this done tomorrow. It's like, this is not happening tomorrow. One, they're not in my time zone and I'm not staying awake 24 hours a day doing this. Typically it's, I would say, anywhere from a week to 2 weeks. From a process perspective, you have to first establish communications with the attacker.
Yeah.
Find out what their demand is. You got to get proof that they actually took data. You got to get proof that they can decrypt data. Typically how I would operate it would be, hey, give me a file listing of all of the files that you took so that I can pick from those files. Because if I just ask for, hey, give me proof that you took files, attacker can send back two files and say, here's proof, and it's junk data. It's granted, it comes from my organization or my client organization, but it's not, in my book, proof. That does, and hopefully, there's probably attackers listening to this podcast, so hopefully not. But, one of the goals behind that is getting that list of data. I can arm the incident response team and the forensics team to hone in on where they need to look. If you go into an organization with thousands of servers, I don't want to spend all day, hitting 20 different file servers trying to figure out what the data might be that the attacker took. Give me, even if it's a partial listing, it gives me a breadcrumb that we can use from a response perspective to get an understanding of the data that the attacker took. Once we have that understanding, then we can proceed forward on expanding the investigation if needed, as well as gauging how much of a predicament is the client in. Is this data truly critical? Is it something really they need to worry about? And if the attacker gives me back junk data, then as a negotiator, I go back and it's like, that data is not worth anything. I don't care if you have that data. And then once all of those steps are done and they can prove that they can decrypt the file, that's when I start talking money. I don't want to talk money until all of those check boxes have been done. I have seen cases, unbelievable cases, where an attacker gets in, they have super, super valuable data. My brain immediately went to like, oh, this is an oh shit moment. The attacker comes back and it's like, we want $300,000. And I'm like, what? They don't realize what they have. And you go back to the organization and you're like, here's the demand. And they're like, just pay it. We don't even want to negotiate. We just want to pay to get the data taken off the dark web and us back to operations. And in cases like that, I get it. You're getting your systems recovered, you're getting the data off, and I'm using my air quotes for those who can't see, off the dark web. I'm sorry, but once your data's out, it's out. There's no guarantees. I've seen too many cases where an attacker comes back, after we've basically wrapped everything up, and then the customer comes back to us and they're like, they want money. They still have files. It's like, well, what'd you expect? There's no proof that they deleted all copies. And that's something we tried to educate clients on all the time. Like, you're taking a risk mitigating move. There's no guarantees. One, you could have a different attacker group that exfiltrated the data and sold it to multiple brokers. Or you just got unlucky and you didn't fix the hole and the attacker just redid everything. No way to ever know.
No, completely true.
Now, obviously, there's hit and run. You got infected by clicking on a link, and it's automated. There's not really been any infiltration. There isn't somebody in there looking for your machine. It just zipped up and encrypted everything on your drive. That's a very different kind of ransomware attack than the ones that you're describing, Jeff, where somebody's been wrecked your entire organization, and they've been inside your infrastructure maybe for months or years. They know exactly what you're doing and where everything is, and then they target specifically valuable data. And indeed, they exfiltrate some of it. So not only do you have an encrypted in place problem, you have a blackmail scenario where they are threatening to release sensitive documents, etc. I see that you do a lot of forensics first. So what you're saying is that it's not the negotiation is really coming second. That a lot of the work you're doing is investigatory, and you're trying to get the lay of the land and kind of figure out what have these guys really got, what have they done, how long have they been in there, and what do they know? Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. Most of the cases that I have done in the past, we're working for organizations that have been compromised. Yeah, my brother got hit. You click on the execute or you click on the website and they encrypt your personal computer. There's not much you can really do about that other than, ask an IT shop if there's something that they can do. Sometimes you get lucky and they didn't really encrypt the system. You know, you can boot it with another disk and get your files back. I'm call it paranoid. So I would take that disk out, build a new system, and try to get the data back and, move the safe data. I don't see many of those cases. I think there was one case that I did in 3 years' time where it was an individual that got ransomed. And it was, unfortunately, it was a small business owner. It was a gentleman, I remember correctly. And I feel so bad for him to this day. His systems got encrypted. He's just a small town lawyer somewhere in New York State. And he worked, if I recall correctly, I don't want to call it charity cases, but more, he wasn't in this to make a lot of money. And he got hit and they, it was one of the double extortions. You run the key, the tool that they give you to identify all the keys that they need. And then you got to pay to get the decryptor, but you got to pay to get the keys. And it was just, it was an endless cycle. They would just keep doing it over and over. As long as you would keep paying, they would keep partially decrypting. And it was just, he went, I think he paid, I want to say maybe $5,000. He just said, it's not worth it. I'm just closing shop. I'm done. I'm not going to do this anymore. And it's unfortunate. I mean, sometimes, I think of the nastiness of the ransomware attackers, and the lack of morals. And when I was doing negotiations back with Crypsis and Palo, we could, if it was a children's hospital, we could pull on those heartstrings, the attacker. There were times where they would be like, we're sorry. Hey, here's the decryption key. We didn't mean to hit.
Sorry, we have some morals.
Exactly. That's gone. That's out the window. I haven't seen that. I haven't seen that at, I would say in the last 2 years. If they hit a hospital and if they hit a kid's hospital, they don't care. They want money.
Just a random thought that I had. Are you entirely sure, Jeff, that you're dealing with human beings, and I mean that literally, and that really scripted AI hasn't taken over quite a lot of it? And, surely that is what's going to happen, that you're going to be dealing more and more with machine learning systems that are negotiating against you, they're gaming against you. Is that a game that you can win?
I don't know if that'll be a winnable game. Let me think about that. I think they'll get there. I think the attackers will, at some point evolve into that. I mean, they already use AI for creating ransomware and creating attack tools. The negotiation process, I don't know. Hopefully not, because I still, there's that heart element that you hope you get the negotiation with someone who has even the minuscule heart. The Grinch that stole Christmas. They've got a little bit of a heart in there. And you hope you can pull on it. if we get to the point where it's AI, which could also become a detriment for them, if we can figure out ways to exploit their AI and, you know, reduce our ransom payments, all right, maybe it's not a bad idea. Cat and mouse. It has been since the very beginning of viruses and AV and firewalls and then EDR, and it's going to continue on. It's just you keep going. The only way, here's the doom and gloom part. The only way I see this truly ending is if we stop using computers, because you can put in a million times prevention. There's always there's a human at the other side that wants to get things done, and they will do it at no matter what cost. It's just going to keep going.
Well, I have faith in you as a human being, Jeff. This is, I'm pleased to hear some of the directions that the conversation's taking, because we have a doomometer. One of the first things that we made for the show about a year ago was a doomometer, because sometimes we were seeing the needle on the doomometer going up to about 9, and then we'd have do we have a siren for it, Ed? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think we probably hit about 8 on this episode so far. We've had worse,
I'm gonna shoot for 10.
Sponsored by Boudica Cybersecurity, maintaining digital realms.
So I was just going to kind of leading on from what we were talking about, actually negotiating with the ransomware gangs or maybe AI in the future. What you've learned in general and with your experience, I was wondering sort of the more technical preventative measures that victims can actually take before they become victims, like, you know, isolating backups, verifying them, air gapping systems, or what are the kind of pain points for cybersecurity awareness for even your like bottom level users that are the most vulnerable?
That's a lot of questions. I think, I don't know, one of the best pieces of advice that I can give, I think, organizations is, and it's tough because looking at it from a business perspective, saving money, obviously increasing profits, it's all very important.
Mm.
But, you know, message out there for the CIOs, CEOs, CISOs, it doesn't mean squat if your systems are down. I see too many organizations that have carte blanche. You know, everybody has access. Everybody's got admin access. You have to start tearing systems off. Your critical systems, admins should not be accessing them from their general workstations. They should be using a different box, different credentials that never touch never touch the internet, period. It's painful, but it's the day we live in. I've never gone, I've ransom negotiations and I've never gone through a ransomware attack myself or for an organization that I directly worked for. I can only imagine this is one of the most painful experiences to go through as an executive. Mm. I remember, and this is kind of dating me, but I remember Code Red and NIMDA. Yeah. And so the organization I worked in, this was funny. This is where I kind of like made that segue from the admin, network admin to security. Yeah. The company I worked for got hit by NIMDA. And so I worked for a company that had two branches, one company and the other company. I did Windows admin for the one company. They got hit by NIMDA on the other side. All my systems were patched. I mean, it was patching. It was easy. And I was at lunch. I remember this to this day. I was at lunch at a Mexican restaurant over here in Wisconsin. And I got a frantic phone call like, you need to get back in the office. Our online operations, everything is down. And I'm like, 1 second. Looked online. I'm like, no, our systems are fine. My systems are fine. I don't know what you're talking about. They're like, we got a worm that's running through the network. So I just Googled it. I'm like, oh, my systems are all patched. Don't worry about it. I'll be back in after lunch. and the CEO called me. He's like, no. We need you in the office. I'm like, all right. Yeah. So I quickly finished, went into the office, and it was chaos. This is kind of what I think of a ransomware attack. It was chaos in the data center. Like, and it was funny because the data center had badged access, but the door was propped open. Everybody was in there, like leaning over the IT people standing, you know, who are sitting frantically trying to restore from backup.
Like a movie.
And it was funny. I walked in. I'm like, dude, what are you doing? Like, we restored from backup. And immediately we're like, it's just reinfected. And I'm like, did you apply the patch? And they're like, what? I was like, take the system offline, restore from backup. apply the patches and then move on. And it was like just this magic moment. And that's kind of where I got hooked into security. Like, really? It's not this hard. But then we had, you know, I look back at it, you know, now, and it's like, we had admins who were, no offense to the neckbeards that are out there, but, you know, they were always right. They were never wrong. It was, this is the way it's done. And it was like, you gotta shift your thinking. We're in a new day and age. And I think that's kind of what it is with ransomware as well. And honestly, just in attacks in general.
Okay, Jeff, could you tell us a bit about identity systems and how they're integrated and how they work?
So yeah, at Simperis, we are focused on identity and only really protecting the identity, recovering the identity. My team specifically, we are a product-based company. We have two community-driven or community-sourced projects out there, Purple Knight and Forest Druid. Purple Knight will assess AD from a security configuration standpoint. And give you somewhat of a score of where you stand, where some of the vulnerabilities are that you need to take mind of and fix. A lot of times those are the exact areas that attackers are exploiting. And then Forest Druid, which takes a look at the attack paths for an organization or, you know, how an attacker is going to come in from an unknown system into a tier zero object. I like to look at it from a perspective of Forest Druid is looking at it from a defender view and, you know, trying to give IT admins insight into how an attacker would move inside of an environment to, you know, those critical assets. That's kind of where the response came into earlier of tiering access. If you have tiered out your systems, less likelihood of an attacker, you know, getting into that critical assets. One of the top ones that we see in, so my team specifically, we do assessments and help companies recover when there is an identity attack. One of the top findings that we see all the time is the help desk. They're there for a reason, but if they have the ability to change domain admin password, that means they are domain admins.
Yeah,
they needed to be treated as such. I would say in every assessment, in every IR case we have done in the past 2 years, that's been the case, is the help desk is, you know, it's one of the prime attack vectors. From other products that the Simperis team has, and I think we've got about 400, 450 employees now. I came in about 2 years ago, and I think we just cracked over 100 at the time, 150. So it's been super, super growth. The two primary products that we have that are, you know, paid software is Directory Services Protector, and that is basically your monitoring on-prem AD for changes that are happening in real time. And we are keeping an audit log of what's being changed. From my perspective is, if an attacker would add themselves to the domain admin group and you've got it configured appropriately, we will remove them from the domain admin group. With automation and scripting, there's a potential that they could be in there long enough. But from what I've seen in our work with DSP, it's quick enough where it's stopping their scripts from working. And then we have ADFR, Active Directory Forest Recovery, which is, I would say, probably the biggest tool that my team uses on a regular basis from an IR perspective. If there is some semblance of an Active Directory server, domain controller still available, we'll go in, basically deploy ADFR, get a backup of Active Directory. Mind you, I'm not saying the domain controller, because domain controller, you're talking gigabytes of data, where we're looking at 80 specifics. We're looking at, I've seen some pretty big DIT files. consider a very small slice of the operating system that we're bringing. And by doing that, we're removing executables from a compromised domain controller. Anything, if I recall correctly, anything that's involved in executable from a sysvol perspective that's being backed up is basically being renamed so that it cannot execute once it gets landed into a restore. So then, you know, my team from a IR perspective, we take, and this is what brought me to the company, or one of the things that brought me to the company. We take what I've seen organizations do historically in 6 months into a weekend. One of the last cases that I did at my previous employer, literally the client decided they were going to rebuild everything. And I sometimes I think organizations don't really understand what that really means. You need to reassign permissions. You need to recreate users. You need to recreate server objects, workstation objects. And you need to assign all of those permissions to the groups and users. You can't just put them back. But if you're using ADFR and we get a copy of AD, we speedline that process of recovering, because then you can take that server backup of a file server and just put that back. And all of those user permissions from AD that we're bringing back, they're in place and intact. And it's, you know, we're good to go. I've seen where we have done a backup and recovery of an Active Directory forest for 5,000 users, and we were ready to roll back into production before the IR firm had figured out what was going on.
Incredible.
Yeah, we started on a Friday, and we were ready Saturday night to roll back. IR provider wasn't ready until Sunday night.
That's amazing. That's really good stuff.
Welcome to our workplace cybersecurity training. Our course is unique, flexible study, very high academic quality, and high impact. Especially built by an expert team of university professors to deliver the same standard of teaching you'd find at a top university, but for beginners. If you're interested and want us to be part of your journey to better company cybersecurity, contact us at Boudica, boudicasecurity.com.
Jeff, could you tell us about, in your experience, maybe why victims don't choose to go to police or law enforcement and the issues surrounding that?
Yeah, that's an easy question. Historically, law enforcement has said they don't do it. Which law enforcement group do you go to? Do you go to the local police, state police, county police, you know, county sheriff, FBI? All depends upon, you know, I guess how big of an organization you are. Do you have a year while they investigate? I know that I've got some friends who are in the FBI and in the digital crimes section, and their backlog is huge. I mean, if they just took down Evil Corp, that tells me they're 5 years behind.
Yeah.
I don't know any organization that's going to wait for 5 years. And then the scare tactics that the attackers use. So in the case of an individual user that falls for a, you know, a clickbait ransom type engagement, typically what does it say on the screen? It says, you know, this is an FBI notification. We have seized your computer. They're using fear. The attackers, that they know what they're doing. They've been around long enough. And if it's, and if they don't know what they're doing, there's enough material out on the world wide web to tell them exactly what they need to do. I think they're doing the best that they can with what the data that they have. I just think it's unfortunate that organizations are going to be very, I'll call it gun shy, with engaging with law enforcement. Just from the historical perspective, I've seen cases, and I've been part of cases where the FBI was brought in and, you know, then they want all types of access to all systems, and they want to run collections that, you know, to me, if the FBI comes and knocks on my door and says they want to scan all my systems, I got nothing to hide.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it doesn't mean I'm giving them carte blanche access to see
all. No. I mean, I guess on a, in a more direct point, and when we're talking about how long and the delay as well for the law enforcement cases, I mean, why do you think negotiations in general take so long and kind of get protracted, or they're just pushed away? And as you say, that Evil Corp case is, what, 5 years behind? So it seems to be a stacking up issue. It's not really getting any quicker either.
I think there's a difference in what we're talking about, though. Should the FBI be involved and understand what cases we are working? Absolutely. If I, as an organization, want to go to the FBI, it's not going to do me anything to recover. There have been cases in the past where the FBI had a decryptor available that they made available if you reached out to them as an IR organization for individual clients. They would literally generate a key for us. It's rare. It's not going to be, I don't think that's going to be the normal case. The investigation, I mean, think about it from a murder case. They don't go to jail the next day.
No.
nothing's put back in place. They have to do their job. They have to investigate, and they got to make it an enforceable event where they can, you know, hopefully put someone behind bars. And that's not going to be something that's going to happen overnight. It's not going to be something that happens in a month. Hmm. It's going to take years. They need to understand what the damages were and some of the specifics so that they can build that case and they can take action. Granted, like I said, Evil Corp's 5 years old. It's, you know, they've got a backlog. I still give them a lot of kudos for getting to that point and, you know, taking action. Hopefully it sets an example.
Yeah.
But it's not gonna. Look at organized crime. In the, you know, just in the general sense. It's been there forever. It's gonna be there forever. There's no getting past it. But dealing with law enforcement to investigate and take action on the crimes, absolutely, they should be involved.
Mm.
But if an organization goes in thinking they're going to help from a recovery standpoint,
yeah,
and don't hold your breath.
I think from the law enforcement point of view as well, that there was kind of mixed messages. They changed their message from we can't do anything to pay and just pay the ransom and you know get it over and done with, to kind of don't pay the ransom, let us investigate. And there's kind of mixed messages around there. What would you kind of say to people that are kind of, they don't know what to do in those cases? Would you say outreach to a professional again? And
outreach. Oh, so from an organizational level, if you have cyber insurance, talk to your broker or whatever is in your contract, follow those guidelines to a T, because the minute you go off stray and, you know, use someone who's a buddy because you're going to give you a deal, you got to pay for it on your own. And there's no guarantees. You know, work with professionals, get a good reputable law firm. Obviously, it's all going to be part of the breach coach, breach experience. Cost money. I'm sorry. You have to follow that process. I think in most cases, if they have to engage with law enforcement, they will. Mm. I don't know if anything's changed in the last couple of years, so I don't do ransom negotiations anymore. I enjoy my sleep.
Yeah.
I know when I was getting ready to leave, we had to divulge more when a payment actually was made, or if we heard of a payment being made.
This episode of The Cyber Show is kindly sponsored by Boudica Cybersecurity.
Okay, Jeff, so we've had a look at Semperus's recent ransomware report, and we've kind of found that even though the number of companies that are attacked for ransom is high, it's not always a one-time threat. So could you kind of explain more about those findings and what you kind of take away from that?
Yeah, absolutely. Once an attack has happened and I have successfully ransomed you, you are on a list. I know I can get a payment out of you. I'm going to do it again and again and again. And it kind of went back to an example that we had earlier. Honestly, not surprising. If an organization, if they pay a ransom once, what are the chances they're going to pay it again? I've done ransom cases where they've been extorted three times. You get extorted to get your keys back. Two, you get extorted to have the data taken off the dark web. Three, you get extorted to destroy the information. Like, who says they're going to destroy it? Even in the best case scenario, where I, as a negotiator, am lining up all of these questions to, you know, hey, are you going to do this? Are you going to do this? Are you going to do this? Doesn't mean anything. Organizations have to go in with a mindset. If they haven't been attacked, kudos to you. I don't think you found it yet, but you've been attacked. If you've survived a ransomware attack without paying, awesome. Your data's still out there. If the attacker's got data, I have no faith that they've destroyed the data.
Yeah.
We've even seen an organization getting attacked, ransomed, and then separately, the CEO got targeted, individually extorted.
Yeah.
Criminals are criminals.
I mean, I suppose the other thing from that report is that we found that companies aren't necessarily prepared to beat ransomware either. And that's what you're kind of saying there, with even the CEOs are getting targeted because they kind of go, oh, these suckers are going to fall, you know, they're not prepared for that. Let's see what else we can get. And that's where it kind of, you know, easy target list, basically.
Absolutely. And I mean, hopefully this doesn't evolve to this, but if I, as an attacker, gain access and steal a bunch of information from you, one, you pay the ransom, or two, you don't pay the ransom. You know, they've started calling. They will pay a firm to bounce through a bunch of phones and directly call you.
Yeah.
Well, if I have that information and I know who the CEO is and I know who the CFO is, why can't I ship them a package? You print out a bunch of paper and then ship that.
Yeah.
I could bounce that through a number of couriers too and just continually highlight the threat. Unfortunately, the best thing that organizations can do is to prepare with a mindset of being breached, being extorted. Plan for it, prepare for it, exercise for it, learn how to recover quickly. And, you know, if you have valuable data, treat it as such. Don't give carte blanche access throughout your organization to everybody who thinks they need access, because they don't.
Do we think that, as an overall protection, does cyber insurance, in your opinion, do you think it helps or hinders the current situation with also a link to law enforcement and you know, that mixed messaging? What would you say is kind of the agreeable route? Should people just rely on cyber insurance, follow that to a T, or what should they do?
No, I'm not for or against cyber insurance. I have my pain points with cyber insurance. I think organizations, if they're going to go the route of following exactly what cyber insurance says and does, we are going to be in no better of a spot, because a cyber insurance company is going to say, you have to have, you know, for example, you have to have EDR deployed to all your endpoints. Okay, now you have to have EDR deployed, and it has to be up to date, and it has to be a specific version number, and it's going to continually evolve. And there is no silver bullet. But nothing's going to stop this to a T. It is a lot of people, process, and tech. And that's why all three are there, because all three need to be addressed. You're not going to solve anything with one specific technology. You're not going to solve anything with just one specific process. It's everything has to work combined. Are there great tools out there? Absolutely. There are some great tools. But an organization is going to look at it from a risk mitigation perspective. And that's what I saw in ransom negotiations was, typically we go, well, we can spend $20 million on this, you know, whatever EDR product, or we can run the risk and spend $2 million on a ransom. Well, okay, I'm going to go to whatever's the least affordable or, you know, least cost intensive, and save money. And then you've got the whole people side of, well, we don't really need all these security people, or we don't need all these IT people. Let's just shorten our staff. Well, you shorten the staff, you shorten the tech. We're just, it's all snowballing up into a lot worse of a situation. From a cyber insurance perspective, you have to know what the rules of engagement are. If you are going to get the problem that I had with cyber insurance, and this is for all those cyber insurers out there, stop demanding negotiators get approval on all messages sent to an attacker. Literally, I had to, if I wanted to make contact with the attacker, even just a, hey, I'm the dumb IT guy, how do I get my data back? I had to get that verbiage approved from the insurance company.
I mean, that kind of contributes to that prolonging of the resolution as well, doesn't it?
Exactly. Especially if you get, you know, if you're unlucky enough. I had one, you know, I was doing negotiations, and it was literally, no offense to the guys over you in the UK side, but me being in the States, there was a huge time difference. So I had to deal with the attacker who was in the middle of the night for me. And then if I wanted to respond, I had to get approval from the UK side. Well, if I got my response from the attacker late in the day, it's not a free-flowing conversation.
No.
If your organization or if the organization you hired understands the negotiation process, they know what they're doing. Let them do what they need to do and communicate. When I start talking money, yeah, you bet, I'm going to make sure you approve every message I send, because I don't want to speak out of turn when it's dealing with money. But if it's dealing with establishing contact, proof of life, proof of decryption, no, you don't need to be part of that.
So if we slightly turning the table a bit, I was just thinking, obviously we've spoken about ransomware and the threats that come with that. We talked about the data, but you know, we don't know if it's ever going to get deleted. How would you say ransomware actually differs from, say, blackmail? What is there a difference there? Can you categorize it?
There's no difference. So extortion is extortion, blackmail, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
It is a part of a ransomware case. Mm. Originally, they didn't take data. Originally, they encrypted systems. Then they learned that, well, if an organization has a good enough backup, they don't care. They're not going to talk to you.
Mm.
They increased their leverage to force you to talk to them. Mm. Now they realize, oh, well, this data is valuable. And I've seen cases where they don't even encrypt. They just take the data and they say, hey, here's the treasure trove of information that we have.
Mm.
Do you want it released?
Yeah.
They don't. What's more valuable, access to the systems or the actual data that you have? Sometimes it's the data. And that's why they've changed. So it's a unfortunate evolution of the process.
I read a book chapter a few years ago, and it was about the machinations and skullduggery in the media business, especially with film companies, where they, the classic crime or story that, that illustrates it is when you have a little rich girl who colludes with the fake kidnapper to get some of rich daddy's money, you know, and you come to this scenario and not everything is as it seems. There is more that meets the eye. And sometimes in the film business, it's the case that film companies want sneak previews. They want stuff to be released, but for legal reasons, intellectual property reasons, they can't do that. So they get hacked with massive scare quotes around it.
Music industry does and, the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Have you seen any of that kind of thing, or have you encountered any kind of cases which, once you dug a little bit below the surface, you thought, oh, I'm in something here that's not what it seems?
Yes. Like I said, the music industry is notorious for doing that as well. Hacked, and they all of a sudden the music shows up, but it's not the right music, but it gives you enough of a sneak peek that you want to, you know, dig in and buy the album. And I've seen cases, and you know, you just sometimes you get that feel, sometimes you just never know. How do I know that, going back to the example that I gave earlier with the little old lady that wired out those payments, how do I know she wasn't in on it? Sometimes there is a breadcrumb that's left behind, and I've run into this where, you know, we see some anomaly as an investigation team or a digital forensics team, and it points to an insider being involved.
Mm.
Different story. Usually that's where, you know, one, ransom negotiations and negotiations at all, and including the investigation, takes a very hard pivot. Usually at that point, we get on a call with the, you know, the executive sponsors of whatever engagement it is. And we have a heart to heart of, hey, you know, something's wrong, something's fishy. And, you know, until we have, it goes, you know, all the way back to the law enforcement example. If I don't have evidence and I don't have enough to back it up, I'm not making a claim and falsely accusing someone of something. But if I have evidence and I have breadcrumbs, I can start pulling on threads. And if the data shows me and leads me to the conclusion that someone is on the inside, absolutely. That's one of the reasons that I liked focusing in on the ransomware side, is I was somewhat detached from what the investigation team was doing, but I would feed them information and they would feed me information. If something didn't add up, because we should be seeing the same conversation, the same information. If there is an anomaly and we see something different, or if they, you know, just happily stumble across it, you got to pull on that thread. You got to look.
Yeah.
The state of the economy over here in the U.S., and I don't know how it is across the world, but insider threats, it's a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if an organization not paying their employees enough, and that employee is, you know, having a hard time making ends meet, damn sure someone's going to be looking for a way to make money.
Totally.
There's always a chance where, you know, everybody has morals, everybody has ethics. There's going to be a point in time where there's going to be a tipping scale. There, unfortunately, there's going to be some times where people go down the wrong path, and it is what it is. Like I said, I've run into those cases. I would say those are my least favorite, because a lot of times it's the IT admin that you're talking to about the investigation, and they keep leading you away from something, and you build a rapport with them. But as an outside entity, I have to be detached from that. And it kind of goes the whole, even with the ethics of making payments and feeling sorry for organizations, completely detach myself from that.
Yeah.
Just because if I didn't sleep and I didn't sleep well. And
overwhelming stuff.
Exactly. And if you're trying to juggle multiple $1 million cases, it's just a recipe for bad mental health. And
I think our thermometer's at about 9.5 at the moment.
Yes.
So I know we're coming up on time. I thought it might be important if any of our listeners wondering whether they want to go with Semperis and your products, what would you say to them? Who can they reach out to? And in general, when someone's looking at a cybersecurity firm, what are good green flags to look out for?
You're listening to The Cyber Show.
So anyone can reach out to me, jeffw@semperis.com. I can't guarantee I'm going to be able to respond in time or quickly, but if you have a good question, I'm always happy to try figuring something out and pointing people in the right direction. I would say if you are an IT admin of any organization, first and foremost, www.semperis.com, but also purplenight.com. Download a free version of Purple Knight. We are not pulling data back on statistics of Active Directory. You download the executable. I think you put in your name and your company email, and that's all you need, and that's all we get. Run it. It's a free tool. See what the state of your organization is. Obviously, we've got our assessment side on my team that we go a whole lot deeper, but it gives an organization a good point or a good understanding of what's going on. From a the red flag, green flag of dealing with IR firms. I don't think there's a true way of telling, other than if they guarantee they're going to get your data back, that's your first red flag and immediately hang up the phone. There was one case where a firm, and I don't know if they're still around, but basically this firm guaranteed they would get a ransom demand and ransom recovery. And all they were doing was, so once the client gave them the ransomware note, they were reaching out and already starting before they ever actually had a contract with the client. If you are dealing with a ransomware attack, do not give a firm any information until you have your contracts. Worst thing you can have is multiple people trying to reach out to an attacker. Because if you think the attackers are not monitoring who's making connections, you are wrong.
Jeff, would you mind kind of giving us a few closing remarks about how maybe organizations can protect their identity systems? Obviously, 90% of ransomware attacks are related to identity system theft and loss of information through that route. So would you want to give us a bit more information about how to protect those and the Active Directory systems and everything related to identity?
Absolutely. So, and I like to take it back a step further. Ransomware events, incidents directly tie into the identity. The identity, we said it in the very beginning, the identity is, that's the first step. When an attacker lands in an organization, that's their first step. Originally, go back years, it was breach the firewall. We're past that. Firewalls are nothing. really, you've got to leave the access open and that it's there. The identity has to be the perimeter that we care about the most, because if I get access as an attacker to admin credentials or an admin type system, it is game over for any type of event. Be ransomware from I want money, or the political affiliation of Wiper, where they just come in and destroy.
Yeah.
If I have protected the critical domain privileged accounts enough and systems enough, their chances of making that type of impact are pretty small. In order to do that, we have to tier our systems. I mentioned it earlier. You have to make sure that your controls are in place, you're auditing. You have to be doing backups. And that's, to me, that one is so 1970. why are we still talking about backups?
Yeah.
Backups have been around forever, but organizations still don't test their backups. They don't validate those backups are going to save them in a recovery event. And backup, what's critical I don't care about workstations. Mm. Data shouldn't be on workstations. Don't back those up. I've seen organizations try that. It's absolutely asinine. back up your critical data, control that critical data. And like I said, identity is your perimeter. You need to back that up, because if I can recover your identity space and secure it in a weekend and have you back operational, why would you take months to rebuild that? Or why would you take months to try to recover it? Even if you bring it up in isolation where people can somewhat start working, that's better than being down for, you know, a week, 2 weeks, or a month while the investigators are digging through your network.
I mean, I think it's also that when you say verification of backups, even a step further, I think actually be simulating an attack and actually can you restore from those backups, and how quickly do you get a system restoration to the point where you can operate as a business again as well? And I think that's something that a lot of people miss in that kind of system of restoring from backup. They're like, great, we've got backups. What format are they in? How are they actually restored? And how does that work in the real world?
Yeah, I've seen. So we had a client that we were doing somewhat of a tabletop for. We were looking at what their IR plan was, what their disaster recovery plan was, and their DR plan. Basically, you know, we asked them, what's your objective? What's your recovery objective? They're like, well, we want to be back up in 4 hours. You realize it takes longer than 4 hours to back up that one server. You think it's going to recover faster? And, you know, somewhat level setting that, they have to understand that you want to minimize your recovery time objective, obviously, from a business perspective. But you want to do it safely and have, I don't want to say the right answer. You want to have a better answer than, we're going to be back up this weekend, because it goes back to the media. Media is going to be hounding you, asking you questions. When are you going to be back? When are you going to be back? Customers are going to be, you know, badgering you. When are you going to be back online? What's the status? And if you just say, well, you know, we've got our backups and we're restoring, we'll be back up and operational tomorrow. Great. But they're going to be holding you to that. Set realistic expectations. Test those and validate that you can actually restore within 4 hours or 8 hours or whatever. But please, good Lord, test it.
Yeah. All amazing stuff, Jeff. Thank you so much. And I think it's also important that our audience sleep when they listen to this podcast. So just to kind of round it off and bring that doomometer down slightly, I'm sure a lot of our audience have watched a film called The Negotiator. My question to you is, Kevin Spacey or Samuel L. Jackson?
Gotta go with Samuel. Although, as the negotiator, I have to stay somewhat objective and cool and calm, because the customer, they are the ones that are, their hair's on fire, they're the ones that are sweating bullets, and if I go in all hot and heavy and crazy and I'm not cool, calm and collective when I walk in, it's gonna make my job a whole lot harder. So that's kind of where I fall into Kevin Spacey. If I remember a movie correctly, he was pretty cool, calm and collective in the very beginning. Samuel Jackson was the hothead. And then, if I recall correctly, it flipped at the end. It's a little bit of both, but I do like Samuel, so I got to go with Samuel.
Do you want to just repeat again where our audience can reach out to you or Semperis in general if they've got any other further questions?
www.semperis.com, and then Jeff, J-E-F-F-W, at semperis.com. Feel free to reach out to me.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
I'm hoping that neither we nor any of our listeners ever have to speak to Jeff for any reason except for the very pleasurable conversation that we've had today. You're an absolute star, and it's good to know that you're out there, mate. Good to know that you're out there.
Awesome, thank you.
Brilliant stuff. Thank you so much for joining us, Jeff.
It's been a pleasure, gentlemen. I really had a lot of fun, and I hope I can come back again sometime. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining the Cyber Show.
You've been listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk. We hope you'll be back again soon, because we've got an amazing new season of episodes lined up with some very special guests too. This season, we've got topics from international relations and intelligence sharing to censorship in schools and payment fraud, as well as the usual irreverent dig into everything cyber. See you soon. The Cyber Show.